integrity in each of the services is also critical to a strong military. General Amos, I have become friends with Major James Wyrick, United States Marine Corps, who I sincerely believe is a man of integrity. Did you fear Major Wyrick at any point?
My name is James Wyrick, and this is Military Justice, my podcast about the system of justice that governs those who protect our nation. Welcome back to Military Justice. Thanks for being here again. Today, I am joined again by Butch Bracknell. He's been a frequent guest on the program. And today, we're discussing treason. What is treason? What isn't treason? And we were both prompted to this. He began writing an article, and I had independently been thinking about it because in the news, social media, you hear a lot of people talk about treason and somebody's actions were treasonous. We keep this as a nonpartisan discussion. We're not taking either side on issues, but what we'd like to point out is treason is a very serious crime, and it's in the Constitution. And it should also be reserved for those times that are actually treasonous. It's got certain specific elements, and we try to talk through that. I hope you enjoy this. This isn't only a military justice matter. I mean, you could be accused of treason and not be in the military, but it has a lot of overlap with the military, and we talk about some military cases that could have possibly been viewed as treason, but were not. Thank you, as always, for joining us. Butch Bracknell, let's talk treason.
Hello, James. By talk treason, I hope you mean you're not proposing it.
I am not proposing it. In fact, I think that we all need a little bit of a reminder of what does treason actually mean? It's not just bad things about people we don't like, correct?
If I hear one more person toss this word around cavalierly, James, as you well know, it has a specific constitutional and legal meaning. It means something specific. It's not just a label that we throw on things. It means extra bad. And not everything that has to do with a security-related offense is treasonous. There's lots of offenses that go into the category of, you know, security-related offenses. Even espionage doesn't rise to the level of treason. As bad as it is, it still doesn't meet the elements.
Well, espionage could meet the elements of treason, but only under specific circumstances, right?
Right, in specific circumstances, exactly. An act which meets the definition of espionage could also meet the definition of treason if other factors were present. That's right. But Robert Hansen, for example, did not commit treason, even though he committed espionage.
And he committed espionage for...
He's treasonous. He committed treason. No, he didn't. He committed some offenses, clearly. We all know that. But he didn't commit treason. Neither did Aldred Ames. Neither did Ana Montes, the Cuban spy. Neither did, you know, Chelsea Manning. You hear people talking about they committed treason all the time. That's just not true. They did commit some terrible security-related offenses. They did disadvantage the United States in the security environment, but it doesn't rise to the level of treason.
And I think what a lot of those have in common is the fact that, I mean, one of the elements, as you know, of treason is that it has to be aiding an enemy, and that enemy has to be a declared enemy, not just someone we don't like. So Russia at the moment, China at the moment, Cuba at the moment, none of those are enemies for the purposes of treason.
Right. I think it's an open question as to whether they would have to be an enemy that is a subject of a declaration of war, although a declaration of war would clearly define an enemy for that purpose. I do think that if we went to war against a nation state and a state of armed conflict existed, of international armed conflict existed between us and the other state, even absent a declaration of war, so Al-Qaeda was clearly our enemy, even though it wasn't a state. Could someone have committed treason for Al-Qaeda? I don't know. That gets tied up in Al-Qaeda's status as a non-state actor. But if you took a state, if you took Iran or something like that, if we UN had an armed conflict against Iran, and everybody recognized that we were in an international armed conflict against Iran, and then someone committed an offense that aided the enemy in that circumstance and passed information in a way that, that aided the enemy in waging war against the United States. I think even absent a declaration of war, because you had this clear state-on-state, you know, state of international armed conflict, that you probably would rise to the level of treason. Though, to my knowledge, I don't believe that has ever been addressed by a court.
Right, and part of that comes into play where, you know, the modern way of going to war doesn't really require, nor do even nation states really declare war any longer, for the most
part. The last time the United States did it, the last nation against whom the United States declared war, James, do you remember?
Germany.
Romania.
Romania.
Yeah, Romania was an Axis power, and it's the last, chronologically, the last nation against which the United States has declared war.
Oh, they were the last in line. Yeah. You kind of forget about them. You think they only do gymnastics, but they were also an ass.
and make grappa or whatever that.
Right. You thought they were only into gymnastics, but they were also an Axis power.
They're really good at gymnastics. They weren't that great at being an Axis power, I guess.
Yeah, I think they just had oil. I think that was the only thing that they needed from them at the time.
Yeah, I agree with that, 100%. So, yeah, so and there obviously there hasn't been a declaration of war since then. I don't know if there ever will be one again. I'm here in Virginia, you know, my Senator Tim Kaine is a champion of this issue of Congress getting involved in making decisions about when the United States is in a state of war, and, you know, that is one of his big signature issues, is calling on the executive branch, whether it's he challenged Obama and he challenges Trump, to make it clear, to involve Congress in these decisions and not just make it a, you know, a function of the unitary executive over and over again.
He's in a pretty small minority, but we've also had a prior guest on the show, Congressman Walter B. Jones from your home state of North Carolina. He's of the same opinion, that these kind of open-ended grants of money by Congress is not really what we should be doing for the use of our armed forces. But I would say that there's maybe a handful of those elected individuals in either the Congress or Senate that really address that issue.
I mean, they're happy to hand the power, because when they hand the power over to the president to do it, they kind of are handing the responsibility over too. So if it goes south, it didn't happen on their watch. There's a political accountability issue here, and they're happy to hand that right off. You know, I don't think it's not really been since 1974 in the War Powers Resolution, which is arguably constitutional. There's a big, you know, there's obviously a big legal controversy over that. That who knows? Maybe we could address that sometime. I find it to be an interesting separation of powers issue, but that's kind of the last time it seems to me that Congress has been real interested in really getting its arms around its responsibilities under the war power. And I'm going to use war power to sort of capture the constitutional concept about the sharing of powers to wage war against an enemy between the executive and the legislative branches.
In February of 2018, we just saw Congress pass a lot more authorization for more bombs and other various other equipment around war, and given to now the third administration under the wars we've been in.
Well, it's wild to me. It's as though they can appropriate money and yet somehow distance themselves from the conflict. And the American people seem to be happy with that divide, that Congress just resources, but ultimately the decisions, the big decisions about when we go to war, become fait accompli to a certain extent. I mean, you get, you know, the AUMF for Afghanistan and the AUMF for Iraq, authorization for use of military force, but each of those times, the ball was sufficiently far down the field that any congressman who voted against either one of those would have almost been committing political suicide. Once that ball starts rolling, the American people get on board, you start to see the approval ratings of the president's plans go through the ceiling. You know, no congressman's going to step in front of that train on principle.
Yeah, and kind of circling back to our discussion, you know, that's the focus of this, is a little more. I found something on Twitter today from Lawrence Tribe, eminent jurist and professor, and it's talking about an op-ed about President Trump. And then so Tribe says, either way, Trump is a Putin enabler, guilty of dereliction of duty at minimum, and probably of worse, enough to warrant a trial in the proper tribunal.
Wow. So
right, yeah, please. And this isn't in defense of Trump.
That one out a little more. I don't really know
well, he's coming off a New York Times op-ed, and the op-ed is, I mean, I think very fair criticism of the president and his staff, you know, that he had during his election. I mean, I don't really take issue with those particularly, but this idea of dereliction of duty and in a proper tribunal, I mean, yeah, Professor Tribe has to know what those mean.
Well, I wonder if he hinting merely at impeachment and removal, or because that's not what I, when I hear the word tribunal, that's not what I'm thinking. I mean, although I guess technically those are tribunals and that there's a body that is hearing a specific question of law, in fact. So, but when he says tribunal, I mean, is he talking about a judicial action against the president? Is he talking about an international judicial action against the president? Because, you know, that landscape has changed over the past 20 years, where now international courts are more willing to entertain the concept of pulling a head of state in, although that used to be anathema. They used to be almost a rule against it, you know, a per se rule against it. There's some precedent now with...
It's mostly third world nations, to be fair, yeah.
Libya, you know, you saw the ICC indictments of Gaddafi and his relatives and so forth. So it's not... It's not unheard of now that you could see a head of state in front of an international tribunal. I think that Duterte in Philippines is probably rapidly making a case for himself. If and when he ever leaves power, that he's going to be very careful about where he goes from there. I'd be shocked if the ICC hasn't already taken note of him.
But those are common law international crimes, murders and genocide, things along those lines.
Well, with the ICC, it has to fall within one of the four offenses that are they're defined in the Rome Statute. But yeah, I mean, those are the crimes you're describing are the types of crimes that could be captured within those four crimes.
And I don't think included in there is conspiring with another nation to rig your own election.
No, of course not. And that's certainly well beyond what anything like an international tribunal like the ICC could ever. I mean, this is really a domestic matter, right? Ultimately, because any derelictions which exist here would only really be cognizable under U.S. law.
Wouldn't it be great to be pain-free? You know, to feel like you used to feel. BioWave is the life-changing, non-opioid, effective way to block chronic or acute pain. It's designed to block pain at the push of a button with patented smart pain-blocking technology. Unlike outdated pain relief devices or treatments, BioWave blocks pain at the source. Proven effective and used by more than 30 VAs, active military, SEAL teams, and most NFL, NBA, and MLB teams. Visit BioWave.com to read testimonials from veterans and active military. BioWave, VVA recognized, VA prescribed, FDA cleared, and made in America. If you are a veteran or active duty military or know someone that needs safe, non-opioid, and effective help managing pain, please go to BioWave.com and learn how to get treatment at no cost. Experience BioWave. Block the pain and get back in the game. BioWave.com. Smarter pain blocking technology. The proper tribunal is only impeachment before the Senate.
So it depends on how authoritative you believe the OLC's opinion is that the sitting president can't be indicted. I think that has been the conventional wisdom for years and years. I tend to agree with it. You know, I think that the idea of an unaccountable prosecutor who insulates himself from being fired almost by taking on the president. Obviously, if he gets fired, it's for the purpose of obstructing justice or shutting down a prosecution. So if a guy goes after the president, he's almost bulletproof, absent some sort of Saturday Night Massacre type scenario. So an independent, you know, one of the 93 U.S. attorneys going after the, or even the special counsel going after the president while he's sitting in office, impeachment is a terrible distraction from the president executing his duties day to day. I mean, he's got a lot of responsibility no matter what. Imagine if a president were sitting under the threat of an indictment and having to stand a criminal trial while he was in office. I mean, it would basically cripple one third of the three branches of the federal government.
You know, right.
All of his attention kind of go to that. So I kind of agree. I don't think that after he leaves office, I don't believe he's immune. And I do believe found that he was in office and immune from prosecution if they adopted the proposition that he was, in fact, immune from prosecution. But while in office, I think that's a bridge too far.
And teasing back into Professor Tribe's language that Trump is likely guilty of dereliction of duty. And that is only a crime. That's only a criminal matter under the UCMJ.
Yeah,
as commander in chief.
He's using that term loosely. That's the General McMaster's sort of catchphrase in his book. It's the title of his book where he talks about how the generals and even some of the civilian officials who were asleep at the switch during Vietnam and didn't give candid advice to the policymakers up to the president, didn't stand on principle and say, hey, this is the war's unwinnable. And nobody, there weren't a whole lot of resignations of people willing to throw their stars down on the desk in defense of the troops that were out in the bush getting killed in a war that we knew pretty early on could never be won militarily. So I doubt he's using it in its most precise UCMJ type usage, meaning, but I think he's probably using it to capture a larger concept that the president's not faithfully executing the laws.
Yeah, sorry to be a stickler. I mean, he is a Harvard law professor. It would seem that you might want to be a little more specific with that language. And that, I think, comes back to what you brought up originally, is just these ideas of everybody or everything being treasonous.
Yeah.
Can you take us through, for the lay listener, what is treason?
So it really crept up from the usage in the Middle Ages. The first usage that I've been able to find of it comes from a old English legal philosopher named William Blackstone, who described the difference between what we call petty treason, which was just disloyalty in personal affairs, with low-end disloyalty, and high treason, which was an offense against the king and crown. And it's this concept of high treason, an offense against the nation, an offense against the sovereign, which is what we imported into American law. And there was various treason acts that about 100 years apart, where the English courts and the English legislature sought to limit the scope of what treason actually was and to more well define it, until they eventually passed off to the United States a pretty good definition of high treason, which we all dropped the high. And we just assumed, I believe, the framers assumed that when they described treason, that everyone knew they were describing what the English would have called high treason.
Right.
It's not an insignificant offense. It was mentioned 10 times in the U.S. Constitution and defined in Article 3, Section 3 as levying war against the United States or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. So the two of them, the two uses, the two definitions, it's a dual definition. Levying war against the United States, that's the first form of treason and the elements that are therein. And the other is giving aid and comfort to by adhering to their enemies. So it's basically levying war against the United States or giving aid and comfort to the enemies of the United States. So what it requires then is basically an enemy or an active state of war. And that's just not what you have even the security-related offenses that we talked about. I mean, you can't swing a dead cat anymore without, every second month you've got a high-profile security-related case, whether it's David Petraeus or whether it's Hoff Cartwright or Robert Hansen years ago, Broberg, Dahl, Edward Snowden. And everybody wants to describe these guys as having committed treason, and as we noted earlier, none of them did. All of them committed espionage or unlawful disclosure of classified information or failure to protect classified information or some kind of variety of classification-related offenses, but none of them added up to this really high bar of what the English would have called high treason. None of them were levying war against the United States. None of them were adhering to the enemies and giving aid and comfort to the enemies. They just didn't get to that high level of what would be required.
Right, and I think so we could tease that out to say, like, if you looked at a Snowden or Manning, now our enemies may have derived a secondary benefit from those illegal disclosures, but it wasn't primarily going to Al-Qaeda and giving them information in a secretive manner.
Right. In this context, when we talk about Al-Qaeda or ISIS or even the Russians, I think it's probably more helpful to use the term adversary, because we muddy the water when we call those people enemies. Is Al-Qaeda an enemy of the United States? That's a complicated question. If you adhere to the old definitions where an enemy could only be a state, then no, even though they may be an adversary as a non-state actor. So, yeah, I prefer adversary, because then it doesn't conflate with the use of the word enemy, which appears inside the definition of treason.
Right, right. And then on the other hand, where you have a clear nation state, for example, the Russians,
yep.
And if we go back to Robert Hansen, the yep. Soviets, yep. So then you had clear nation states, but there were not open hostilities.
That's right. That's right. I mean, there was the Cold War. There was this clearly an adversarial nature, clearly proxy conflict. You know, clearly Vietnam was a war, proxy war. Clearly so was Korea. Clearly so was all the conflicts that were in Central America, where it was us against the Russians, you know, struggling. Sometimes some of the things that were going on in Africa became proxy wars. But you never had the United States and Russia going head-to-head. There was no, you know, there was no Wolverines moment or anything like that where we—
Right, right.
Where you could actually declare Russia an enemy of the United States. I think adversary captures it a lot better. And it got pretty hot. I mean, there was a lot of times where the United States and Russia had been at each other's throats. Probably some of it, some things that we won't hear about for another, you know, whatever the declassification period is for top secret compartmentalized information about covert operations in the 70s. There's probably a whole lot of stuff that we don't know about where, you know, Americans and Russians died on each side, where we still wouldn't say that it rose to the level of a war such that you could define the Russians as an enemy.
Right, where we could have
to prosecute Robert Hansen for treason.
Yeah, we could have had a treasonous action if Robert Hansen had, in earlier decades, provided information to either North Korea or North Vietnam. But
yep.
not to Russia. Russia wasn't directly involved in that conflict.
That's right. That's right. And
for the purposes of the treason.
There's been very few treason cases, and to the best of my knowledge, there's only been a couple of treason cases even in the 20th century, even in recent history. Most of the treason cases come from, like, the Whiskey Rebellion. Of course, there were treason prosecutions from the raid on Harper's Ferry with John Brown and the abolitionists, although interesting that they were tried under a state treason statute, which really didn't implicate federal law at all. 29 out of 50 states still have treason statutes on their books, but there hasn't been a modern prosecution, in the, certainly not in the 20th century, under a state treason statute. You know, the most recent treason cases have been from World War II. Tokyo Rose is the most famous example. Axis Sally Gillers, who was a German sympathizer and broadcaster, who also was prosecuted. But again, we haven't had a prosecution like that since, I guess, probably the late 40s, when Tokyo Rose was prosecuted in probably about 47 or 48, I think. And even she was pardoned by President Ford in 1977, based on what Ford saw as just a lack of evidence in her case that she actually ever collaborated and gave aid and comfort to the enemy. There's some evidence of the fact that she was pressed into service, and that even if she gave service willingly, she never did so to the detriment of the United States. So even our most successful treason prosecutions have had gigantic holes in them, such that at least one of them resulted in a presidential pardon. And those things don't come easily, usually. You know, usually the president does it because for some policy reason or because he really believes that there's been a massive miscarriage of justice, and the historical record shows that Ford believed that that was the case with regard to Tokyo Rose.
So, at least to my view, this seems to be a problem on both sides of the political spectrum, almost equally, that they'll misuse treason.
Yeah, I don't like it. I think, you know, the sloppiness in language, we ought to get back to exercising just a shred of discipline. There's lots of ways to describe conduct that you believe is disloyal to the United States without using that word, because it has such a precise meaning. And it is the highest form of disloyalty to the state. So if everything is treason, how will you ever recognize treason when you actually see it?
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, if everything's treason, nothing is.
Right. So if you have Chelsea Manning giving over information to WikiLeaks and you want to characterize that as treason,
right,
then you're really debasing treason.
That's right. That's right. You sort of eroded away the foundations of how seriously we ought to be looking at the act of treason when a future Chelsea Manning, you know, gives over information to the next nation state with which we might find ourselves at war, whether it's Russia, and I'm not advocating that, but there's been a lot of talk about how the elevation of conflict could come between the United States and senior military leaders talking about the inevitability of war with Russia, the inevitability of war with China, the inevitability of war with North Korea. That's if you see information going to one of those states after one of these wars has kicked off, that's when you know you've got a treason in place. So I object to the watering down of the term by its overuse.
No, and I agree with that, especially if you look at China, Iran, and Russia. There are interactions with all of those nation states. Like, depending on what spectrum of war we're talking about, if we're keeping in the cyber spectrum, it's looking a lot like we're coming close to being to declared hostilities.
We're certainly getting to a level of intensity. It's certainly showing itself in a lot of different avenues. It's hard to say because so much of that stuff is so deeply classified.
You know, right.
There's a lot of things going on in the cyber realm every single day between nation states that don't quite rise to the level of international armed conflict. But, you know, you're waiting for the big miscalculation where an electrical grid goes down and 10,000 people die because of a deliberate attack on an electrical grid, or, you know, the floodgates on a dam when the lake above it is at flood stage and, you know, 10,000 people live downstream.
Or your reactor that goes offline because
right. Or your reactor that where the cooling mechanisms go offline and all of a sudden, you know, 30,000 people around Santa Onofre are infected with radiation and 5,000 of them die.
Right. And that, I mean, that's not a science fiction arena that we're talking about.
Not even a little bit.
Well, what else can you help us understand today?
I don't know, but you make me feel so glum talking about these.
Well, no, it's good. I mean, I think that we're here defending the precision of language, that we really want to not just dumb this all down or just reduce it down to this lowest common denominator where if this person's a political enemy of yours or you just don't like them, that they're treasonous traitors to our nation. I mean, that's just not the case.
No. And the real damage here is that we stop being able to recognize it for the awful offense that it is. Again, we haven't seen a single case of it since the late 40s in the United States. So we should preserve the sanctity of that term. We should preserve the seriousness of it so that when we do have another treason prosecution, we are able to recognize the fact that that is unusual and different from the garden variety handing over a secret document to a reporter. You know, I don't endorse that. I don't think that's good. But it is a long, long way from handing over top secret war plans information or, you know, cyber defense information to a nation state with which we're in an active state of hostilities. Those two things are...
Well, and fortunately, you know, just from the pure legal stance, like, we have a lot of other laws that deal with that.
We can give covered without calling everything treason.
Right.
We have plenty of statutes on the books which more than adequately cover the entire waterfront to protect our information without having to call everything treason. You can call it, you know, you can call it offensive to the security of the nation, but it isn't treason.
What else are you working on these days? You writing anything?
I'm writing a piece on treason. I'm in negotiation right now with trying to figure out who's going to publish it for me, but whenever I get it published, it could be task and purpose, could be, you know, one of the usual suspects, but I'll make sure that I send you the link so that you can put it in the show notes.
We'll put that in the show notes along with your Twitter profile
and,
that you're getting better at using.
Hardly, but yeah, a little. I've come to realize, and you keep chastising me about it, it is the favorite medium these days for communicating with sophisticated people. I mean, following the decision makers and the people who are really influencing the security environment, they're not doing it through Facebook, okay? You're right, they're doing it through Twitter.
Well, and that's what that kind of, you know, got under my skin a little bit with Professor Tribe being so, you know, loose with that language.
Yeah.
That,
yeah.
Like, wait, we're looking to you on Twitter. I know that, you know, these aren't law review articles. Some of, you know, it's quicker, but still, we're hoping for some precision so we don't all just, you know, we don't want all of our experts just becoming laymen.
Yeah, and I'm encouraged to see, it's funny you mentioned that. I was just thinking about that the other day about how encouraged I am to see some of the, even Tribe. I mean, Tribe's over 70 years old, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You're right. I mean, hell, he might be 80. I'm not sure. He was old when I was there. And old, I don't mean that disrespectfully. What I mean is he was a giant in the field for a long, long time.
Oh, yeah, 20 years ago when I was in law school.
When I was in law school, back in, you know, I was in law school, and we were in law school in the 90s. And, you know, he was well-established as a scholar then.
Oh, multiple
books. beyond just being a technical expert published in peer-reviewed law journals and moving to be a thought influencer. And the only way to do that is to leave the technical, you know, they still need to write for peer review. They need to be, still be writing at a super high level, but they also can use social media to influence regular folks who don't want to get into the minutia that is required to read a law review article, but are still interested in how some of these thought leaders are thinking on different issues. And it's cool to see folks that you would not expect to embrace Twitter because of the generation gap still using it to influence people's.
Oh, they definitely are.
Yeah.
That and podcasts. Podcasts, probably the most important form of media known to man and woman at any time.
In the realm of military justice, this particular podcast, if you're not listening to it, you're probably being left behind in regard to military justice and national security law. No question.
Absolutely.
You have all the best guests.
That's just
all the best topics.
That's a given.
Yeah.
Any saved rounds for us?
And you're just taking care of the military justice community bigly.
Well, thank you, Butch.
Brilliant. It's always good to talk to you.
Military justice wouldn't be possible without the fine sound editing by Hannah McCarthy. And this episode is dedicated to the memory of my Uber producer, Dreadnought. You will always be missed out here.